I would like to introduce to you a very well-known and a very articulate speaker, Russell, on my right-hand side. And Russell will speak on the theme of the convention, Beyond Our Wildest Dreams. I now hand the meeting over to Russell. Thank you, Russell.
Thank you, everybody. My name is Russell. I'm an ALPOC member of the Carl Gables Group from Miami, Florida. And I really enjoyed myself during this convention. One of the things that's the greatest about it, besides the country, which is beautiful, and the people, is really meeting everybody here. I haven't met everybody, but I've met quite a few of you, and I miss you already. But I happen to believe that in ALPOC Synonymous we'll probably meet again, either spiritually or actually meet again. You know, there's a small A's like a small world. So, you know, and I've got a huge email list, and I say this sincerely. I love to stay in contact with all of you, get your emails and spam you and until you can't stand it. And, you know, I have we have all sorts of functions and stuff in Miami. And let's face it, Miami's a place that people come to. And you wouldn't be surprised. I get people that come from all over the United States. They drop into Miami and you send them off to meetings. We all have lunch, you know what I mean, and dinner, you know, we do that thing. And so, I mean, I really don't feel ill at ease to come up and give me your email. I'll be happy to, if I can find the card, I'll give you one. And, you know, I'd love to hook up with you all again. And, you know, I just love people in Alcoholics Anonymous that are on this deal. And I'm going to, well, I guess my assignment is to speak on that Wildest Dreams thing, which I got to tell you something, I don't see much daylight between Wildest Dreams and Vision for You. So I'm going to sort of fluctuate between the two, but I know you won't believe this, but there's a possibility I'll take a detour or two. It's uncommon for me to do that, but I might take a detour. But I'm going to promise you one thing, which I may or may not be able to deliver on. I'm going to promise you one thing. I'm going to make it back. I might have to do that. I might have to go through Milwaukee first. You understand what I'm saying? You know, I had to get here. I had to go to L.A., then I had to go to Taipei, and then I had to come here, you know? So that's how I'm going to get there, you know? It's not going to be necessarily a nonstop deal. So I'll try not to talk so fast. The American guys, a couple of American guys came up to me and said they enjoyed it because that's how fast their mind's going anyway. And it was sort of like jumping on the freeway, you know? They had the car up to speed already, and so it didn't matter. And but they told me the Australians were having a real problem keeping up. So I don't know whether that's true or not. I met some of the Aussies. They seemed pretty sharp to me, but I don't know. So I'm going to read a few things in the big book, and we're going to get to a few areas. And, you know, I want to tell you, anybody ever see the movie The Goodfellas? Goodfellas? You know, I really, you know, life teaches me so much. I learned so much from, you know, the great thing about Alcoholics Anonymous and the program of recovery I'm involved in is I don't have to be a name to learn. I mean, things come up to me in my everyday life. People come up to me, movies, whatever. And they come into me and God sends them to me. And all of a sudden something comes up from AA or a principle I learned from someplace else, from my church or something like that. And I say, oh, that's what that means. You know what I mean? God has a way of sort of like working because he is all powerful. At least that's what the book says. It says being all powerful. He supplies us with everything we need as long as we stay close to him and do his will. You know, that's actually out of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, by the way, being all powerful. He supplies us everything we need as long as we stay close to him and do his will. That's out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, some of you may think I'm getting like biblical here or scriptural or, you know, but you know something? That's actually out of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. As long as we stay close to him and do his will. And the reason I bring up that crap, you know, because I think it has a lot to do with being rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence, because you know why? I've actually read the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I read the book. Now, some people get disenchanted with that stuff. They think I get too preachy and stuff like that, and, you know, maybe that's true. I had a young guy come up to me. You know, in this book on page 68 of the book, I think it's 68, let me make sure. Let me see, I've marked a couple of things. Let me see where it is. It's probably, let me try to find it. Ah. I wasn't going to read this part, but I thought I'd just tell you this little story. Page 68. We never apologize. Before I get into that, you know, there's a part in this book, because I think most people that go to conventions probably have read this book and are familiar with the program. Before I got, there's a part of this book called Chapter to the Agnostics, right? There's no chapter to the believer, because the whole book's to the believers. But there's a chapter to the agnostics, which, by the way, I'm going to boil down that chapter to you. You know what the chapter to the agnostics is about? It says, here's one line, get over it. But deal with it. Whatever. Okay, listen. So here's the deal. No, he's not a doorknob. I mean, it's okay to start off. That's why we have the fellowship, to tell guys, don't worry, it's a doorknob, you know? But, you know, about the time you get to be about 20 years, you know, you're supposed to figure that out, that how could it be a doorknob if they say being all-powerful? How can it be a doorknob and then they say the Creator lives in your hearts and minds? How can they, you know, it just doesn't fit, you know, King's English. So anyway, here's my point. My point is this, these guys were alcoholics, they're working with alcoholics, we're pretty crazy and touchy and all that sort of stuff. So I understand the deal and I understand why how they do it the way they do. But you know, if you read the book enough and you understand what the deal is, they understood, I know they understood, the founders understood that alcoholics, by and large, initially, and maybe for a long time afterwards and before, sort of hate the concept of God, don't even want to talk about it, don't even like that God stuff. As a matter of fact, you know, they say in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, don't they say somewhere, it says as soon as that's raised up, the hackles in our neck stand up, you know, we can't stand it, we hate everything about it, we don't want to, and I know they knew how to write higher power because they have it in the steps and they have it in the big book. You know, it's mentioned is it 400 or 500 times the word God? Forget about him, the employer with a capital E, throughout the first 164 pages. And so I know they knew how to use the term higher power. And I also know that they knew that alcoholics despised and hated, at least a large portion, the concept of God or being talked to about God. So here's the question I need to ask you. Why'd they even use the word God? Why didn't they just use higher power throughout the entire book? If they knew we hated it, and we knew we didn't like it, and God knows every alcoholic that comes in here, they're trying to figure out how to do it without it. Why don't they just use higher power? You know why? Here's what I think. I think it goes back to that statement by Bill Wilson that he said to Henrietta when he said, the Lord's been so great for me lifting this curse from me. He says, I just got to keep on talking about it. I think Bill Wilson opted to talk about the truth rather than what would pander to people and make them feel better. You understand? You see, I think what he felt is he felt obligated because he was given a new life and he was reborn to tell the truth rather than tell you that which he thought would make you like him. You understand? That's like a non-alcoholic concept. You know? Well, you might... Oh, by the way, did I say reborn? I'm sorry. That's sort of like a biblical word, isn't it? It's sort of like that part in the big book where it says, when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer, with a capital E. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, whoever he is, I don't know, but he's mentioned a lot in here, so I really like to know who he is, or at least find somebody who could point them out to me, or maybe tell me where I could find him, or tell me how I could know him, you know what I mean? There must be somebody, maybe there's somebody in here who could help me with that. It says, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose fear of today, tomorrow, or hereafter. That would be great, wouldn't it? We were reborn. We were reborn. You know what? You know where that comes from? We were reborn. That's actually from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. See, I'm allowed to say that stuff at an AA meeting. You know why? Because it's out of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So getting back, does anybody remember what I was talking about? Page 68. Who said that?
Rock,
thanks a lot. Okay. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. I know you all are wondering how I'm going to get back to the theme. This is the fun part of the whole deal. You know, there's a certain group that is, because you're Alcoholics, you're betting against me. I understand that. You're not necessarily on my side. You want to see some sort of flipping catastrophe here. You know? Well, we'll see. That's what makes it exciting for me, because I have no idea whether I'm going to make it either. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality. By the way, did I talk about the movie Goodfellas?
Oh, yeah.
I mentioned Goodfellas, but I haven't told you what that deal's about yet. Okay, somebody bookmark that deal. We never apologize to anyone for depending. You know, Rock told me, nobody answered me on the bookmark the other day. And I said, you know, I asked him to bookmark me because I never know we're going to make it back. And nobody answered. And Rock said, I think he said this, he says, well, I knew what it was, but I was too scared to say it. You know what I mean? So, you know, believe me, when I ask you to bookmark something, I really mean it because, you know, I need your help on this. I can't do this alone. Yeah, thanks. So, not yet. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality is a way of weakness. Paradoxically, it's a way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. We ask Him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what we would have us, He would. What we have meant means anything. We have a Creator, and each man and woman, you know, whatever race, religion, can form a relation. That's in the big book. So I'm walking out of the Carl Gables group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and some new guy comes up and he says, oh, you're Russell, aren't you? I said, yeah, how you doing? He says, hey, they say you're pretty good. I ought to hear you speak. He says, yeah. He says, but they say you talk too much about God. So let me ask you something. After reading that in our program, what do I say to a newcomer? What is he being taught? What's being happened? What's the deal with this thing? I mean, are we in two different fellowships? Are there like a couple different programs going on? Do I sort of like water it down and say, you know, you're right, you know, we shouldn't talk too much, you know? Because, you know, the problem with watering it down, we could do that and people would feel better, but then, you know, just the only problem is a few people would die. See, a few people would die. Because it'd be a form of AA, but without power. Because that's where the power is. You know, so at least somebody's got to be courageous and do it. But, you know, I don't have much courage, but, you know, through him I can. You know, so I guess that's the way it is. So the bottom line is, in Goodfellas, the guys in the mafia, you know, and I apologize if you haven't seen it, but it's an interesting movie. It's a great movie. I like watching it. And they're always talking about being, the mafia is like such a weird thing. People love the mafia. And I think one of the reasons, I'll tell you why I like the mafia. I'm too chicken to be in the mafia. I believe it. I'd never be able to do it. But the one thing about the mafia is it's these guys that do unbelievably horrible things and they don't give a crap. Sort of like being an alcoholic drinking, but sober. It's sort of like, you know, you ever do that? You have a few drinks. Well, I don't give a shit what they think about me. You know, who the hell they think? They don't know who they're dealing with. You know what I mean? It's sort of like being in the mafia is like being an alcoholic drunk, but you're sober. And you actually do the shit. You know? So it's like fascinating to me that people could actually be that way. You know? And when they talk about that way and that thing, you know what they say? They say the life. They say when you're in the life, they call it the life. Because it's such a way of thinking. It's such a way of being. It's like a different way of life. It's not a program. It's not. It's a life. It's a way of living. That's the way I look about it at AA. That's the way I look at this deal. You're either in the life or you're not in the life. You know, there are people that come in this deal and they do this deal and they have this thing going on, but they're sort of like not sold out to the life. They're not sold out to the life. So here's the situation. I'm looking at this chapter called Vision for You. I think, tell him I'm going to call him back, because I know who that is, and I actually paid that bill. I'm going to talk to him about that. I hate when they do that, you know. I tell them never to bother me about that stuff. Okay, everybody, anybody ever remember this one? Now and then, well, before I get into that, good fellows. Now and then a serious drinker, being dry at the moment, says, I don't miss it at all. Feel better. This thing used to puzzle the hell out of me. Feel better, work better, having a better time. Now I want you to think, this is how AA is so screwy. Now and then a serious drinker, being dry at the moment, says, this is what he says, I feel better, I'm working better, I'm having a better time. Now, here's what a non-AA, or my way of thinking, says. This guy's doing pretty good. Right? This is what AA says. As ex-problem drinkers, we smile at such a sally. We know our friend is like a boy whistling in the dark to keep up his spirits. He fools himself. Inwardly, he would give anything to take a half a dozen drinks and get away with them. He will presently try the old game again, for he isn't happy about his sobriety. He cannot picture life without alcohol. Someday he will be unable to imagine life either with alcohol or without alcohol. Then he will know loneliness as few do. He will be at the jumping off place. He will wish for the end. Would somebody explain to me how you get all that shit from feel better, work better, having a better time? It used to floor me. I didn't understand that deal. Yeah. Injecting politics into the deal. That's okay, Brian. I know you couldn't help yourself. It's okay. And I understand that deal, you know, and I like that kind of stuff. I usually use that stuff as exhibits. You know, I am an attorney. Each alcoholic has a chance to be an exhibit at an AA meeting. But sort of like a show and tell sort of thing. This is like homeroom, and we get to, it's like when we were babies, you know, we have homeroom. We can all sort of act out. But, you know, then I joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and I realized a lot of this has to do less with brain power and more with experience. And I'd run into all these guys that I'd sponsor, and they'd say things like, man, I'm doing great. Don't even worry about me. I got no problems. This is fantastic. And everybody who talked like that drank. Everybody who talked like that drank. And the guys that were saying, oh, man, I'm doing terrible. I'm doing horrible. I need help. I don't know what to do. And everything like that, they all stayed sober. And the guys are saying, feel better, look better. I got this thing licked. Don't worry about me. I don't even, meeting, what do you mean? What do you worry about me? Drinking is like out of the question. Every time a guy said to me, if I heard the words, these words, I ain't never going to drink again, he was off the, it was gone. You know, when 300 guys in 26 years say, I ain't never going to drink again, don't worry about me, and then you never see him again. I don't know how to explain to somebody that as soon as I could shake, I got to the point where I could shake a guy's hand and he'd look at me and say two words and I knew. I know, I can't even explain how you know when you know. Just because of a word that came out of his mouth, of an attitude, of a deal, and I understood why they put that in there. Because it bespoke an attitude. It said something that non-alcoholics could never understand. It said something that some alcoholics couldn't understand. I've got such crazy old ideas that are going to kill me. You know, I got the Roland Hazard old idea. We all have the Roland Hazard old idea, you know. He goes under the treatment. What does he say? He says, having now known the inner workings of my mind, he was convinced that drinking was impossible. You know, what's the next line? Nevertheless, he was drunk in a few weeks. You know, that's my old thinking, you know, that somehow, some way, by some stretch of the imagination, I'm going to control this thing by knowing enough. by understanding enough, by reading enough, by doing this stuff enough. Because if I could do that, if I could really understand this and really know it, then you know something? Screw God. God's not necessary because I'm God. And then he goes back to Dr. Young and he says, is there no hope? And Dr. Young gives him one of these goofy answers here and there once in a while because it was true. We call it phenomena, which means that's the doctor's way of saying they're miracles. We don't understand it. What does it say? Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which I think is the whole deal. Because I don't know what else is going on in your mind except ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were the driving forces of these men's lives, are suddenly cast to one side and they become dominated by a new set of ideas, emotions, and attitudes. Wow, what would that be like? That'd be a cool deal if you could do that deal, huh? You know? And so here we have this thing, in order to get into the steps, what does it say? It says the A, B's, and C's, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. You know, I come in here, one of the biggest concepts I had a problem understanding for years, and I'm not sure I still understand, is the concept of brokenness and powerlessness. I think I gave lip service to it, and I certainly said, well, I'm powerless over alcohol, and I said it enough times, and you started sort of believing it, but I never really quite understood. It's kind of hard to understand the idea, the conception of powerlessness when you can, I don't know, get in a car and drive from here to there, or go to a meeting. They're not going to, it feels like you have some sort of power over the deal, you know, that concept of not having power, and then you start realizing that maybe I'll have a heart attack in the next 3 seconds, that nobody even knows whether they're going to make it back home alive, that you sort of like hang from a thread, and no matter what's going on in your life, and then you understand that no matter what's going on in life, it all hangs by a thread, it's all illusion, that one day you're rich and the next day you're poor, that one day you're healthy and the next day they're giving you radiotherapy for cancer on your neck. One day you got $4,000, the world is great, next day they say it's cancer. And you realize that you really got no power over anything. You're like an ant on a log going down the river. And every once in a while the log comes to a bend in the river and it turns and you think you're steering the log, but basically the log's going where the log's going. You can sort of move a millimeter here and there to get less wet, which is sort of like what I do. But the bottom line is, you know, we don't know. You know, you depend upon yourself, you let yourself down. You depend upon your brain, you depend upon circumstances of life, and you know, life never goes the way you're supposed to go. You know, you depend upon other people, no matter how much they love you, no matter how much they care for you and everything, they'll always let you down. And so we got the A, B's, and C's that says what, we're alcoholic and we can't manage our own lives? Which means what? I've done a study on this, by the way. You look, I'm a lawyer, I'm a wordsmith, I'm going to fill you in on this. The words, the concept, we're alcoholics and cannot manage our own lives, I believe, this is my theory, this is all my opinion, you know, means that if you're an alcoholic, you cannot manage your own life. That no human power could have relieved your alcoholism, which I believe, after a great deal of study, means, don't get ahead of me, that no human power could have relieved your alcoholism. You know what that means? That means, you know, that guy's not going to do it, the wife's not going to do it, the husband, if I was only married, going to do it, the job's not going to do it. It means no human power. And then there's that third thing. We're supposed to be, what does it say after this? It says, being convinced of this. And here's the third thing, that God could and would if you seek him. Seek him. Well, what does they say? See to it that your relationship with him, there he is again. There he is again, sticking his nose in our business. See to it your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and not countless others. So how do I answer that guy when he says, you talk too much about God? They say you're okay, you're entertaining, all that, but you don't. How do I answer him? How do I tell him that that's the whole deal? I talk about him because he saved my life. Do I say, well, the people in Bali don't like it? Or they may not like me? Or maybe I should change the message? Maybe I should rip that stuff out of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe I should change the message to suit Bali. You know? And I understand the concerns. I want to be respectful. And anybody who thinks that I'm espousing a particular religion would be wrong. I'm espousing Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I was telling somebody today, you know, my religion, my personal religion, prohibits me from imposing it on anybody. It obligates me to expose you to things. You know, and in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, you know what it says in the big book? I think it says this in the big book. See, I'm a big book guy. I get my orders from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think what it says in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, let me find it. I read it. It was in the deal right here. So let me see. It says, each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. So what's to stop me to tell you about how I established my... how is that? Where does it say in A that I'm not allowed to talk about this stuff? Now, you may not like it. I'm not talking about this group, because I'm not necessarily said, but the people in A may not like it, but that has less to do with me and more to do with what's going inside of them. Right? That's the deal on that deal. So in any event, in Vision for You, it says, now and then a serious drink or being dried mouth, it says, feel better, look better, have it. And this is what it says at the end, if you see. It says, we know our boy is like a boy whistling in the dark, keep his feet. He fools himself. Inwardly, he would give anything to take a half a dozen drinks and get away with them. He will presently try the old game again for, you ready? For he is not happy with his sobriety. And that's really what I want to talk about for the most part when I talk about segue into this stuff. Do you think it's possible to be sober in AA and not happy? Do you think that's possible? Anybody who's been around for more than 10 years or 5 years knows that deals. Because you know the truth is you don't even experience alcoholism until you're sober. You don't. Getting drunk is a way of not experiencing alcoholism. Drinking is a symptom. Isn't that what it says? It says drinking is a real disease sends their mind. You know, I'll tell you what alcoholism is. Alcoholism is when you're 18 months sober and you want to put a gun in your mouth to blow your brains out and you hate the world and you hate yourself and everything's turned against you and everything's dark and you know it can't be booze because you haven't had booze in 18 months and it's not because it's something called alcoholism. How can you experience it? I'll tell you what I did when I was experiencing alcoholism, that the first sign of alcoholism, as soon as it turned on, I said, I need a drink. You don't experience alcoholism. You experience something called drunk. It's different. Well, drunk. Drunk is for people who don't have the guts to handle alcoholism. Oh, that's a keeper. And you know something? I didn't even steal that one from anybody, I don't think. Somebody must have said it somewhere. Brian, you can have that one. You can take that back to Cleveland with you. You know, really, when you think about it, so you know, you don't really experience this deal until after you get sober. That's when you experience alcoholism. And when I say, when I say the thing about the happy, he's not happy about it. I understand. One thing I understand, I didn't like it at first, and now I appreciate it. That part and parcel of this deal, this crushing and mushing to get us and shape us and form us so that we grow and we have a further connection with him, part of that is to be put through the grinder. I read the 7th chapter of the 12 and 12 where it says how we get new perspectives on things as we're going on. It's not in step one, although step one is part of it. I read the part where it says through 1,000 forms, 100 forms of pain and humiliation and the final crushing of our self-sufficiency. I read the part where it says we learn to see how suffering can be of great value. I know what it's like to be 9 years sober, lose all your credit cards, be bankrupt, and have $50 in the bank, and have a wife and 4 kids, and be 6 months in arrearage in your mortgage, and not knowing where the money's coming from. I know what it's like to go through that sober. I know what it's like to go through cancer sober. I know what it's like to go through death of people sober. I know what it's like when circumstances in your life are crushing you, and it doesn't seem to have any hope, and you're sober. I know what it's like to go through the horse shit. And I know what's on the other end of that deal. I know what's on the other end of that deal. If you make it through, if you have your eyes, if you understand this other thing, if you understand the one thing that's important, the only thing that's important, you know, there's only one thing that's important. I was accused yesterday of not saying what the one thing was. I don't know how that happens. All I do is talk about the one thing. Every word about my mouth has to be the one thing. Even a stupid newcomer is accusing me of talking too much about the one thing. I spend the whole night reading about the one thing. Jim's saying, listen, do me a favor, don't talk so much about the one thing. And I walk out of here and somebody comes up to me and says, you know, you didn't say what the one thing was. You know, you can't win in this group. I mean, all the steps are basically tools. It's not the steps. The steps aren't important. I mean, I'm a step guy. The steps aren't important. Steps are tools. It's like if you use a hammer and a nail and a whatever it is and a saw to build a house and you're done, you don't sit around and worship the hammer. Do you? You live in the house. If you lose the steps to get you, if the whole deal is your relationship with God, see what you and the whole step is about finally getting to the point that there is a God, you can have a relationship with him. I don't care what you call him. You know, I know a couple of things about him. You know what I know? I know he's all powerful. You know why? Because it says in the big book of Alpha and Omega, he's all power. Doesn't never made any sense to me to have like a less than all powerful God. As a matter of fact, I don't even have a higher power. Do you know that? I really don't have a higher power. It seemed goofy to me to have a higher power. You know, I mean, if you got your choice, I decided to choose the highest power. I figured, why not? Because I got some whale-ass problems. I don't want to fool around with some mini power, you know what I mean? I went to the highest power, you know, that's why I'm not worried about you guys, you know what I mean? So the point is, you go through, you know, A to B is like a car wash. You're on a conveyor, you guys have been in a car wash, you get on that little conveyor belt, you go through the car wash, and the only difference is you start off sort of dirty, and you go in that car wash, and the only difference is instead of water, there's like 1,000 guys in there with giant hammers beating the shit out of you for your entire life. And here's the deal, the trick is, you don't ever want to fall off the conveyor belt. That's the worldly clamor shit. Because we get distracted so easily about, you know, the guys with the gals with the guys, and the this and the that, and the money and all that stuff. All that stuff beckoning us to distract us because we know it's so important. It's so important. I went up to my sponsor. I said, they're going to foreclose on my house. You know, I got problems. Where am I going to get the money? He looks at me, and you know what he says to me? He says, I think it's about time you started making coffee for the group. And I'm saying, I think he's like psychotic. I mean, aren't you listening to me? My life is over. My kids are going to be out on the street. And he says, really, I think you ought to make coffee. Make coffee. And I wanted to get another sponsor. I wanted to quit, but I didn't want to drink. And I didn't want to upset him. And I wanted him to like whatever the heck it was. So I started making coffee for the group. And then 18 months, I'm making coffee. I'm saying, you know, first I hated the job. And then I said, well, nobody can do this job better. Then they couldn't take it out of my hands because nobody, you know. Then I tried to give it away and nobody would take it. I said, nobody's going to take this job from me. He says, just stop. I said, what do you mean just stop? I got to do the coffee. He says, no, just stop. He says, nobody's going to take it from you unless you stop. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. You're going to stop and then somebody will start making the coffee, you know. And you know, when he said make coffee, you know what he was really saying to me in alcohol code? He said, it's not about the money, Russ. It's about the one thing. It's all about the one thing. That was his way of telling me that it's about the one thing. And if I focused on the one thing, I wouldn't fall off the conveyor belt and the house would be taken care of. And you know what happened? I didn't fall off the conveyor belt. I stayed sober and the house was taken care of. And so what happens is you go through that conveyor belt and you know, guys are taking their eyes. They're looking at the gal. The gals are looking at the guys. They're looking at the money and everything. They're off the conveyor belt. And I'm just hanging on the conveyor belt. You know why? Because I'm looking and I'm all over the place. But you know something? For whatever reason, I just keep on looking at the one thing. And so I hang on the conveyor belt, about 3/4 away from the conveyor belt. They're beating the shit out of me. And you know what? It's starting to sort of feel like a Swedish massage. It's feeling pretty good, you know? All of a sudden, I'm down the conveyor belt. I'm saying, hey, you know, this ain't half bad. By the time you get off the conveyor belt, you say, man, I want to do that shit again. Because it doesn't bother me like it bothers you. Because life starts bothering you. And all of a sudden, you don't look at problems as problems. You embrace them because that's God's MRI. You know, if you go to the hospital, you want him to give you an MRI because you want to see what's wrong. In AA, he sends you problems. He sends you difficulties. You know, because when it disturbs you, there's something wrong with you. And if you're a good AA-er and you know this deal, and you look to yourself and you don't look to your brother and see what's going on in his eye, you look to yourself, what that tells you is that's God's way of giving you MRI. So it's, if it's bothered you, this must be something I need to work on. As a matter of fact, if I piss you off, it's like a spiritual MRI. You're saying, I'm pissed off. Why am I pissed off at this guy? And then you'll figure it out and something will happen. You'll pray off it and you'll change. As a matter of fact, if I piss you off, it really is like you owe me money. I should get paid, you know, like a co-payment at least or something. You know, some sort of medical thing, you know. Guys come up to me and they say things like, blah, blah, so-and-so bothers me. And they tell me about some sort of problem. He screwed me on the money. He did this and blah, blah, blah. He did this. So here's what I said. How would you feel if it didn't bother you? He said, what do you mean? I said, well, how would you feel if it didn't bother you? What do you mean if it didn't bother me? I said, well, if it didn't bother you, how would you feel? You mean if it didn't bother me, he bounced the check and he says, yeah, if it didn't bother you, how would you feel? You mean if it didn't bother me? He says, yeah, if it didn't bother you. You mean if it didn't bother me that he did this stuff? He says, yeah, if it didn't bother you, how would you feel? Well, if it didn't bother me, I suppose I'd feel okay. I said, there you go. So here's the deal. When I talk about, now listen to me. Do you think it's possible not to be happy? Now, the 12th step is about the joy of living. That's the theme of the joy. And the joy of living, what I understand now today, and I can't explain it to you, you're just going to have to go through the thing. You have to buy your own ticket on this one. It's about having a joyous attitude while the shit's being beaten out of you. Because you know in the end it's going to be victory. You know, I can't explain it. It's different than the self-pity, because I'm a self-pityaholic. Anything worth thinking about is worth feeling sorry for myself about. You ever notice in AA meetings that there's always these two types of critters, and I'm not saying there's abundance of one another. There's always the guy, I don't care whether it's 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 2,000 years, there's always something to complain about, something to bitch about, somebody to talk bad about, somebody to bad mouth about. And there's always a guy, you never see him talk bad about anybody else. He always has something positive to say. He seems like he has any problems. You know, what you think when you're newcomers, you think, well, that guy must be a multi-gazillionaire. He doesn't have any problems. And then you find out, like Al Kennedy has cancer. You can't compute that deal. You can't figure that deal out. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were the guiding force of these men's lives, are suddenly pushed aside and they become dominated by a whole different set of ideas, emotions, attitude. How do you grab a hold of that stuff? How would you get that gold? How do you do that deal? How do you get involved in that life? That's even different than just not drinking, don't you think? That's even worse. Do you think it's possible to have 14 years and be unhappy? You think it's happened to have 20 years sobriety and be unhappy? Listen. I see the old curmudgeon. I see the guys with the 14, 15, 20 years that, are at AA meetings, they're giving their opinion. They ain't sponsoring anybody because nobody wants what they have. They're just pissed off. You know, I know what you see because you're around here long enough, you get to see the difference. You get to, here's the great news. It's your life. It's your life. It's not my life. You don't have to do anything. You know something? You can walk out of here and say, well, that guy's pretty much full of shit. You know, that's okay. You're allowed to do that because you know what? It's your life. It ain't a dress rehearsal. I just don't want to come to the end of my life and, be lying there and say, boy, I screwed that up. You know what I mean? Boy, I could have done it. Why didn't I go to that? You know, for me, I happen to be a Bible. Why didn't I go to that Bible study? Why? Because... Well, they may laugh at me, and because I was worried about somebody laughing at me. Some guy who doesn't even pay my visa bill laughing at me because I'm worried about that. Why was I worried about it? I don't want to learn at 87 years old that I missed the whole deal and didn't have an open mind because I was worried about some warthog in the back row laughing at me because I feel so crummy about myself that everybody's got to like me. I mean, A's got to be something. It's got to give me something better than that. And so, in order to understand all that deal, we really got to talk about the minors. You know, you don't mind if I talk about the minors for a second. I know Jimmy told me not to talk about the minors. But that's better than the Leo story, don't you think? Jimmy told me not to talk about the minors because apparently he's been, I won't do this, I won't about you. He's allowed, it wasn't copyrighted, but it is a true story. I want to tell this story. Because this, if you understand this, what I'm about to say, and this is just my opinion, you know, this is just my life. I'm talking about each person's individual. If you understand this, you understand about this whole deal. So I want to give you a little gift of something, which means a lot to me. It meant a lot to me when I heard it from I stole this from somebody else. But it was okay, because he doesn't even realize I stole it from him. And he didn't, it's a long story. I'll tell you that backstory later on. But and you know something, was okay with him because he gave it to me freely. And it wasn't even in an AA meeting. Can you imagine that? I went to a Bible study somewhere and some guy said this. He started talking about this crap. He said this story. And I woke up. I was sleeping, because that's what happens when people are reading. I fall asleep, you know. And all of a sudden I started telling this story and I started listening to this story. And it all came together for me. And 6 months later, I was doing some sort of convention or some sort of deal, and I wanted to tell the story, and I called the guy up. And I said, where'd you get that story about the miners? I said, I know it's a true story. And he says, what? And you know what he said to me? It changed my life. This story changed. This is one of, when I say it changed my life, there's been millions of stories that have changed my life. There's been gazillions of people that have come to my life that have changed my life. But this happened to be one of the stories that changed my life. And it made things so clear to me about this deal. And it even made clear to me about this thing that they say after the guy who's unhappy, he says, is there going to be a sufficient substitute, the fellowship? And all the stuff that I learned today came together in this story. And I said to him, I called this guy about the story that changed my life, because I wanted to find out more about him, where he got it. I finally had to look it up on the internet. And I told him about the story that he told 6 months ago. And you know what he said to me? He wasn't even an alcoholic. I've actually met people that are on the same road I am, that one is looking for, you know, the same, you know, him, that him guy, looking for him, you know, and they're on the same road, they're looking for the deal, you know, and they're not even drinkers. Imagine, who the hell do they think they are? I hate that crap when they try to do that stuff, you know, and I've learned stuff from them too. So here's, and you know what he said to me when I said, could you tell him about that story? He said, you ready for this? He said, what story? I said, the story you told about the miners. And he said, I never told that story. The thing that was most one like an important thing in my life, he didn't even remember saying it. You know, when you have this thing going for you, you should be radioactive. You should be walking into people's lives. They walk away, you say, who the hell was that guy? What the hell was that? That was something, you know? Not even know it. You may drop a word, you may say something, somebody's life changed their entire life, you'll never know about it. All of a sudden, kids aren't being beaten, wives aren't being abused, people aren't drinking. You walk away, you don't even know. You see, we used to leave people's hearts in our wake. You know, because you know, whenever you're talking to people, whenever I talk to somebody, I try to talk to people like they have a broken heart, because most of the time they do. Did you know that? Most of the time they do. So the miners. So this is a true story. This is all about Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is all about who's going to make it and who isn't. This is the deal. In April of 1863, there was a party. There was a town called Bannock, Montana. Bannock, Montana, they had a gold strike in 1862. It wasn't the largest gold strike in the United States. It wasn't like California, but it was pretty big. But by 1863, it had panned out. And so in 1863, in April 9th of 1863, a whole group of about a few hundred miners set out from Bannock to the Black Hills, Crow Country. They had Paiutes there and everything like that, Indians, in order to scout out for gold, to prospect for gold. And what happened was there was a group of seven guys, and they were lagging behind. They missed the connection. And so they start off a week later. And they start off from Bannock, and one of the guys was a guy named Fairchild, Bill Fairchild, or Fairweather. A guy named Henry Edgar was one of the guys, and there was a scout, and they sort of got lost, and they got captured by the Crow Indians. Now, there's a whole story about what happened when they got captured by the Crow Indians, and Bill Fairweather, he was probably an alcoholic. He started pulling rattlesnakes from his clothes, and they thought he was crazy, so they let him go, and the only guy that stayed with the Indians was the guy who was the scout, and six of them left. And to make a long story short, they're making their way back to Bannock. And as they're getting back to Bannock, they stop at a place called what's later called Alden's Creek, Alden's Gulch, to water the horses because they're out of supplies. And while the men went to water the horses, Henry Edgar and Bill Fairweather scouted out, you know, went prospecting themselves, and they found some rimrock by the gulch, by this little gulch, and they got a chisel and they got a couple of hammers and they got a pan. And they started panning for gold, and they found $12 worth of gold right there in that rim rock, which was back then in like the 1860s, like a lot, I don't know what that's like, but $500 worth of gold or something now, just by tapping a few things. And so they called the rest of the party there and they started tapping for gold, and after about 2 days they found $200 worth of gold. Now the Alden's Creek, it turned out to be one of the largest finds in the history of the United States as far as a gold mine is concerned. I think they took out like $85 million worth of gold in a few years, which was like billions back then. So they had discovered, they had hit the mother lode. They had hit something. So I want you to imagine, you're sitting there, and you're a prospector, and you're poor, and all of a sudden you've hit the lottery. You've hit what everybody's looking for. You've hit the mother lode. Now back then what happened was, there were guys looking to jump your claim or take your money away from you and all that sort of stuff. So the one thing they had to do, they were out of supplies. They had to go into town, they had to get supplies, and they had to work the claim in order to have the claim. But here's what they were worried about. If anybody got wind of the claim, then their claim would be jumped and they might lose it. So, you know, I mean, I remember there's an old mobster named Santos Traficante. He says, if you want to keep a secret among three people, two of them got to be dead. Sorry, reverting back to my criminal lawyer days. But in any event, so the bottom line is that they go back into town and they swear an oath that nobody's going to say nothing to anybody. What they're going to do is they're going to go in, they're going to get their supplies, they're going to get out, and they're going to meet by the old oak tree. I think they're thinking, what they were thinking is like somebody spilled the beans. You know, somebody talked. You know, and so when they finally got together with the guys and they, you know, everything sort of worked out for them, they became multimillionaires anyway, and they, because they wanted to find out how they knew. So they went to the lead guy in the party and they say, how'd you know? And this is what the guy said. You know what he said? He said, nobody talked. He said, nobody talked. He said, we could see it in your eyes. We could see it in your eyes. We could see it in your eyes. We knew you had hit the mother lode. You see, we got a big fellowship here. You know, when I was sitting in the front row and I saw Al Kennedy from last night doing his deal, loving on people, and he was an alcoholic and I knew he was. He was dying of terminal cancer. He didn't mention a word about it. He became one of my miners. I could see it in his eyes. I mean, I could see the difference between sobriety and sobriety. I could see the possibilities. I could see the vision of where this thing could take me. I could see, I've been hanging around that old oak tree ever since, looking for those miners. Been hanging around ever since looking for those guys. That's what this deal is all about. Finding those people and getting close to them and hanging out with them. You know, and I didn't even realize that. And I didn't realize everybody didn't see it. I thought everybody in that room saw what was going on with Al Kennedy. I didn't realize there were guys in the back that were joking. There were other guys that weren't even in the room. There were guys that were worried about, that were looking at his watch saying, I got to get out of here. Doesn't this guy, I think he's going to talk more than 15 minutes. He's got to, I didn't realize that. I was there. This guy could have talked for 5 hours. I was staying there because I wanted what he had. You know, here's the deal. You remember what it said in the first part of the book? He says, if you want, this isn't about doing the steps and staying sober. Did somebody tell you you do the steps, you'll stay sober? You know, that's a lie. That's an outright lie. Most of the people I know that drank have done the steps. I mean, maybe it's different in Australia and Europe. I can tell you guys that taught the steps that drank. I know a lot of guys that do the steps and drink. I wish it was as simple as doing the steps. That's why I know it's about one thing. You know, I wish the steps would keep you sober. That we'd have a lot more people in this room. I know people that have 5, 10, 15, 20 years that drink. They've done the steps 50 billion times. They drink. I wish it was the steps. I'll tell you one thing. When it says in the book, see to it your relationship with him is right, it doesn't say see to it that you do the fourth step and great events will come to pass. See to it that you do the fifth step and great events. It doesn't say that. Does it? It says see to it that your relationship, you know, you do the steps from here until the cows come home. You don't have that relationship going. You don't have that deal, in my opinion. I want to say in my opinion because, hey, I could be wrong. I might rethink this thing. So in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, what it says, if you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, isn't that what it says? It doesn't say do the steps, does it? And you'll stay sober. There's a step before the steps, isn't there? There's a precondition. You know, I went to school. I got a degree. I got a bunch of degrees, you know? And we used to, in order to take calculus, you had to take trigonometry. In order to take trigonometry, you got to take algebra. You know, there were things that, you know, I forgot what they called them, preconditions or prerequisites. There's a step before you take the steps. It says, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. You know, we have them come in here ready. We have them come in here not ready, right? We got some guys come in here and they don't want what we have. They don't want what we have at all. You know, they just want to, they want to get sober for a while, whatever they want to do, and then they want to get the hell out of here. You know what I mean? They're planning their escape as soon as they have their first chip, you know, their first day. They're digging that tunnel underground. They're like, remember the movie The Great Escape? Some of them, you're not too young for that. The Great Escape, he says, they're in the German concentration, and they're basically tunneling underground to get out of AA. They've already started with the tunnel. There's other people that want what we have, but, you know, they just don't want to give up that relationship. They want what we have, but, you know, they just don't want to stop working in that bar. They want what we have, they just don't want to start doing that stuff. They're just not willing to go to any length. It says, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready. But here's the deal. In order to even qualify for that, you want what we have, you got to have a we. Don't you have to have a we? I mean, if I say, well, if you want what we have, and you say, who's your we? Who's your we? Who's the we? Who's the person? Who's the vision? What's the deal that you're looking at that you say, I want what that guy has? What's that group? Who is it that you're looking at? I was looking at Al Kennedy. I was looking at the... You know, if you don't have a we, then you know what? Then you don't have a we. Then I guess you're looking at you. I ran my life for 31 years. Didn't work out too well for me. Probably worked out better for you guys. You got to have a we. You know, what I learned when I read Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, this was about a love story. You know the guys, and Brian's from Cleveland, it's good. I used to read that thing, and I'd say, they had groups. You know, Bob loved Bill, and Bill loved Bob. And everybody in Akron, Cleveland loved Bob. Couldn't stand Bill, you know what I mean? And everybody in New York loved Bill, couldn't stand Bob. And it was all about one giant love story. We don't put people on pedestals because we're all sick. But you wanted some? Don't kid yourself. We're all looking at each other. And Bob was looking at Bill. And Bill was looking at Sam Shoemaker and Ed Dowling. And they were looking at someplace else. And people are looking at Bill. They're looking at, and you have your Bills and your Bobs. And there's not an old-timer in this room, not an old-timer with 26 years in this room that's happy, joyous, and free. If I don't sit him down, he's going to give me names. He's going to say, old Charlie, I'll never forget Joe. Or he's going to be talking about the men in his life or the women in his life that made the difference, that changed what their deal was. And so that somehow they locked up with that situation, they followed those miners, they got their we together, and they got a vision. They caught a vision. Because if you're not looking at them to catch a vision and looking at them, and you know all those guys, where are they going to point you? They're pointing you to this book. They're pointing you to other places. They're pointing you away from those worldly clamors and the things you shouldn't be looking at. Until all of a sudden people are sort of like looking at you. All of a sudden you're the guy. You're sort of like walking around, you know. And all of a sudden you're living a life beyond your wildest dreams. And all of a sudden here's the deal. All of a sudden you're on page 295 of him sold, he sold himself short. One of my favorite stories. This is what he said. These last 18 years have been the happiest of my life, trite though that statement may seem. 15 of those years I would not have enjoyed had I continued drinking. Doctors told me before I stopped that I had only 3 years at the outside to live. This latest part of my life has had a purpose, not in the great things accomplished, but in daily living. Courage to face each day has replaced the fears and uncertainties of earlier years. Acceptance of things as they are has replaced the old impatient chomping at the bit to conquer the world. I have stopped tilting at windmills and instead have tried to accomplish the little daily tasks, unimportant in themselves, but tasks that are an integral part of living fully. Where derision, contempt, and pity were once shown me, I now enjoy the respect of many people. Where once I had casual acquaintances, all of whom were fair-weather friends, I now have a host of friends who accept me for what I am. And over my 8 years, I have made many real, honest, sincere friendships that I shall always cherish. I'm rated as a modestly successful man. My stock of material goods isn't great. But I have a fortune in friendships, courage, self-assurance, and an honest appraisal of my own abilities. Above all, I have gained the greatest thing accorded to any man, the love and understanding of a gracious God. The love and understanding of a gracious God who has lifted me from the alcoholic scrap heap to a position of trust where I have been able to reap the rich rewards that come from showing a little love for others and from serving them as I can. Not much different than what Bill Wilson said to Henrietta. Not much different than every man or woman in AA I've ever met that had their shit together. So what am I going to tell that kid who says, but you talk too much about God? What should I tell him? Just do good orderly direction? Should I just tell him something to make him feel better? Just, have some more Xanax? You know, go to another AA dance? What do I tell him? What do I tell him? God bless you.
Thank you, Russell. That's a good fellow. It was totally remiss of me at the start of the meeting. I should have asked Sabai at the back to read from the big book. Sabai, please.
I'm Sabai, an alcoholic. I need a new pair of glasses. No mental defense. We know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drinks, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. We are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens, both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. These observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting this terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. If you ask him why he started on that last bender, the chances are he will offer you any one of the 100 alibis. Sometimes these excuses have a certain plausibility, but none of them really make sense in light of the havoc an alcoholic's drinking bout creates. They sound like philosophy of the man who, having a headache, beats himself with a hammer so that he can't feel the ache. If you draw this fallacious reasoning to the hammer so that he reasoning to the attention of the alcoholic, he will laugh of it or become irritated and refuse to talk. Once in a while he may tell the truth, and the truth, strange to say, is usually that he has no more idea why he took the first drink than you have. Some drinkers have excuses with which they are satisfied part of the time, but in their hearts they really do not know why they do it. Once this malady has a real hold, they are a baffled lot. There is the obsession that somehow, someday, they will beat the game, but they often suspect they are down for the count. How true this is, few realize in a vague way their families and friends sense. that these drinkers are normally abnormal, but every day, hopefully, awaits the day when the sufferer will rouse himself from his lethargy and asserts his power of will. The tragedy of truth is that if the man be a real alcoholic, the happy day may not arrive. He has lost control. At a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is absolutely of no avail. This tragic situation has already arrived in practically every case long before it is suspected. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink.
Thank you, Sabai. Okay, it's almost time to close the meeting now, and just before I close the meeting, I will ask Mancha, please, to come up and read a portion from the 10th step promise.
Mancha! I'm Pancha, alcoholic from Malaysia. 10 steps promises. And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. For by this time, sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in alcohol. If tempted, we will recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this happened automatically. We will see that new attitude towards liquor has given us without any thoughts or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, or neither we are avoiding temptation. We feel, though, we have been placed in a position of naturality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react so long as we keep it in fit spiritual condition. Thank you.
Thank you, Prancha.